however you want to do it. You can discuss that with the volunteer that takes the call. The important thing is that we hear from you. 244-9455, and we thank you very much. In this part of Focus 580, our guest for the program is Stanley Coren, a man who is quite well known as an authority on dogs, their behavior, their makeup. He's professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia. He has appeared on many television programs and radio shows, a national public radio, too. He hosts a weekly television show, which is called Good Dog, and it's currently showing nationally in Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. He makes his home in Vancouver, British Columbia, and is the author of a number of books. And the most recent is titled How Dogs Think, Understanding the Canine Mind. It's published by the Free Press. And if you're interested in learning more about dogs, you can go out to the bookstore and look for the book. And, of course, questions are welcome here on the program. That's what we hope will happen. If you have questions about dog behavior or any other aspects of their makeup, particularly we're talking about their sort of emotional, psychological makeup, you can give us a call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Then we also have that toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Please do call in, just like always. No one will grab you on the way and make you pledge. It would be nice if people did, but that's not required to call into the program. Again, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Dr. Coren, hello.
Hello, David.
Thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
It's interesting that I think the kinds of questions you pose, just the very basic questions, questions like, do dogs think, and what does the world look like to them, and do they have anything like consciousness? Maybe, you know, even when we talk about human beings, we're still not quite sure what that means. It's the kind of things that probably, if you've lived with a dog, you've asked yourself this question. You maybe even asked the dog, and the dog was no help. And I think they're really interesting questions. And I guess now, are there many serious scientists who are, in fact, pursuing answers to those questions?
Well, actually, there's been a spate of research, mostly in Europe. It's very difficult to run dog research here in North America because, well, to be very blunt about it, the easiest way to get an animal lab closed is to be seen bringing a dog into it, because the animal rights people get very, very upset, even if you're just doing behavioral research. Here in North America, what we have to do is we do research by actually going out to people's homes and setting up much more informal things in fields and associated with dog shows and that sort of thing. But in Europe, there are a number of researchers, a wonderful character from Hungary by the name of Chenier, who are beginning to do some exquisite research in terms of how dogs think and that sort of thing. So, the answer is yes, and I will tell you that, knowledge that we have about the dog has been burgeoning. I mean, if I would have written this book based on research up to about 1996, it would have been a very different book, because prior to that time, we had the belief that, dogs can learn things, but they don't learn by just simply observing people or other dogs. There was no evidence for that, although there was lots and lots of knowledge in the dog world that dogs clearly, because they're social animals, should be sort of watching other dogs and learning behaviors from them. And if you've had dogs, I mean, every dog owner knows, if they've had more than one dog at a time, that the easiest way to teach a puppy the routine around the house is to bring him into a house with an adult dog who already knows the rules. Your housebreaking is infinitely faster. The dog seems to learn his commands much faster and that sort of thing. And it's simply from watching the other dog. And in, the St. Bernards, which are used for rescue work in the Alps. At the Hospice of St. Bernard, the dogs are sent out in groups of three. And what happens is that if they find somebody who's trapped out over there in the snow, two of the dogs will stay with him, sort of snuggle up next to him to keep him warm, lick his face to try to bring him back to consciousness. And one will sort of run back to go get help from the monks. And, you know, how to train a dog to do that? I mean, setting up a program for that would be incredibly difficult. So, but it turns out to be the case that the way the dogs are actually trained is that novice dogs are simply sent out with a team of rescue dogs who already know the business, and they learn from just simply observing, and they'll even make the decision: am I going to be a stayer or a goer in these instances? And now we've got lots and lots of data, which is all new, within the past 10 years, which shows just how well dogs can learn by simply observing. They can even learn words by watching people use words.
Mm-hmm. Well, that now that you bring that up, that reminds me of there was a story in the news. Now I don't know. I guess it must have been last year that got a lot of attention about a dog that was supposed to have a several hundred word vocabulary.
That's Rico, a border collie.
Right. And there were probably some chuckling about it, but also asking some questions, some good questions about, well, now, wait a minute, how do we know this? How do we measure this? Is there something special about this dog and the relationship between the dog and the people who work with the dog? Could any dog do that? Is it just this dog?
Well, way back in 1991, when I wrote the book, The Intelligence of Dogs, we estimated that the average dog has the language ability about the equivalent of a two-year-old child. And the super dogs have a language ability equivalent to maybe about a two-and-a-half-year-old. Now, what that means is for the average dog, that dog is going to know something in the vicinity of about 165 words, signs, signals, that sort of thing. And for the super dogs, it could be up to about 300 words. So Rico is actually, you know, higher than the average dog, which is not surprising since the border collie is the brightest dog in dogdom. So he's higher than the average dog, but he is, you know, he's not out of sight. He's sort of right in the a range which we would really like to see the dogs. Now, the interesting thing about Rico and the way that he learns language tells us something about how dogs think. You see, the way that we tell that Rico knows the words is we either tell him to do something and he does it, or we tell him to go out and find a particular article from a pile of articles on the floor. And he goes out and he gets it. Now, suppose that I put out a half a dozen articles on the floor, and I say to Rico, go find the Framis. Now, he's never heard the word Framis before in his life. But he runs out, and he looks at the articles, and he knows the name of five of them, and he doesn't know the name of the sixth one. And he decides on his own that that must be the Framis. And so he'll grab that and he'll bring it back. And next, later on, when we go back and test him again at some later time, and we put out a whole bunch of articles, including what we had named the Framis, and we say, Rico, go get the Framis, he'll go out and get the appropriate article. Now, this sort of fast track or exclusion learning, you know, learning what the answer must be on the basis of, you know everything else, so it's like Sherlock Holmes when you've eliminated all of the possible things. Whatever remains must be the answer. Well, we thought that that was an exclusively human and maybe, you know, for some of the brighter primates like the chimpanzees, we thought that that was exclusively sort of a primate learning capacity. And now we can see that it's in the dog.
Mm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Stanley Coren. He is widely known for his best-selling books on dogs. He is professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver and has, in his research, covered many areas of psychology, of human psychology. He is the author of a recently published book, How Dogs Think, Understanding the Canine Mind. It's published by the Free Press, and his other books are also, I'm sure, available in the bookstore if you're interested. Also here in this part of Focus, your questions are welcome. You have questions about dogs, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Some of the beginning sections of the book have to do with the senses, the various, and how it is that dogs collect information about the world. And I think that probably people are used to the idea that dogs have a very acute sense of smell, and that's why they're used as trackers and to sniff out bombs and drugs and so forth, and that they also have very acute senses of hearing. I think, though, that I'm interested, maybe you talk a little bit about vision, because that's one of those areas that I think there seems to be popular misconception about how well or how poorly dogs see, particularly when it comes to color.
Yeah, well, you have to understand that dogs, for dogs, the sense of vision is not their dominant sense. It is for human beings. But for dogs, it's number three. Sense of smell is number one. Sense of hearing is number two. And the sense of sight is number three. Dogs have the eyes of a night hunter. Now, what that means is that their eyes are very sensitive to light, much more so than our eyes. They have more of the special receptors in the eyes called rods, which pick up low levels of light. And they're much more attuned to movement, as a hunter would need. So they can pick up smaller bits of movement. And by the way, it's because they're so well-tuned to pick up movement that a lot of dogs don't watch television, because in order to be sensitive to movement, you also have to be sensitive to things like flickering. And the TV set here in North America is repainted about 60 times a second, and so for a dog, it looks like it's flickering. Now, some dogs will ignore the flickering and pay attention to a dog on the set, but many will just simply ignore it because it doesn't look like it's real. But when it comes to color, it's not as important. If mostly you work at night or in dim light, color doesn't provide a whole lot of information there. And for a long time, there's this big misconception about dogs when, you know, somebody says, well, dogs don't have the same color vision that human beings are, they're colorblind. And people think, well, that means that they see in shades of gray. Well, that's not the way that they see. In fact, some wonderful and painstaking research has shown that dogs really see the world in colors, but the colors are much more limited and probably a bit dimmer than they are for human beings. And their colors are basically shades of yellows, blues, and grays. Now, their color vision has a certain implication because right now, for example, the most popular color dog toy is either red or that safety orange, which you see on traffic cones and vests and that sort of thing. And the interesting thing about that is that that color is seen exactly the same, just a little bit darker, than as the color that the green of grass would be seen as. People go out and they buy this sexy new red toy and they throw it and Lassie runs right by it and they think the dog is being either stupid or obstinate. Well, that red color is out over there because it's striking to human beings. And the person who throws it in the grass can find it easily if the dog misses it, but it's not the right color if you actually want the dog to see it.
We have a number of callers who would like to get in on the conversation, so why don't we do that here, starting with a listener this morning in Indiana, line number four, toll-free line. Hello. So our caller there, line four.
Hello?
Yeah, there we go. We got you.
Go ahead. I had my ear in the wrong place. Actually, a story that was given to me 2 weeks ago by a family member about a cat in the family that I know nothing about the cat. But when I was growing up here in Indiana, we had incredible stories about dogs being dropped off in St. Louis or, you know, wherever, and they'd show up, you know, in a matter of weeks or days or something like that. And I remember as a youngster seeing one of those dogs, you know, actually show up in the yard of a friend of mine that had been dropped off somewhere, you know, over the months. At that age, things got a lot larger, so I don't know how far it actually was, but it undoubtedly was a distance that humans found, you know, incredibly remarkable that an animal such as a dog could find its way back to a home, you know, especially dogs that were left outside of cities in rural areas, you know. And I wonder if you could speak to that, you know, where are we really in understanding that kind of perception or sensibility?
Well, the first thing which we have to note is that, yes, some dogs, in fact, do have this remarkable sense of home and can, in fact, find the home. But, of course, an awful lot of dogs go missing and don't show up again. So the truly spectacular stories may, in fact, have to do with the particular abilities of a specific dog. Now, probably the most popular story about a dog coming home is the one which Eric Knight wrote up as Lassie Come Home. And that's based on a true story. And it's a story of a dog which actually traveled some 600 miles to go from the tip of Scotland all the way back to England. Now, there have been some cases in which a dog has traveled considerably farther. There is a documented story of a dog who traveled almost the entire width of the continent of Australia in order to get home. Now, we don't exactly know how dogs do this, and for a while we used to think it had something to do with the ability to pick up the angle of the sun and that sort of thing, but that kind of research has never really confirmed itself. We do now believe, however, that different places in the world smell differently to dogs, and some people will notice, for example, that, you know, if they're traveling, let's say, to a country home, which they go to frequently, or they've been out traveling and they're returning to the city, that as you begin to get closer to home, the dog will begin to get very active in the car, and if the dog might have been sleeping before, but will suddenly seem to recognize that they've come back to a familiar smell. And that's been used by some people who wanted to find a dog. There was a case in which a dog was left, unfortunately, at a gas station when the family stopped for gas. They didn't notice the dog had hopped out of the car. They were 100 miles or so away when they recognized the dog wasn't there, and so they drove back and they couldn't find the dog, called it, and that sort of thing. So what they ended up doing was they took some of their dirty clothing and made a line along the highway. Every few yards or so, they would drop another piece of clothing between the gas station and a little motel there, and they stayed at the motel for 2 days, and sure enough, the dog found the line of clothes and worked his way to the motel and was reunited with his family.
We are at a point here where we need to take a little break, and we will take some more calls in just a moment. And Dr. Korn, if you wouldn't mind just holding on for a second here while we remind people how important their support is for the station. The number we would like you to call is not the number for this show, but it's the number to make a pledge, and that is 244 9455. We have a lot of people who over the years have supported us very, very generously. And to them, we want to say thanks. We wouldn't still be here without you. But there are a lot of people who listen to the radio station who have not supported us. And we hope that if you could, you might do that right now. You might go to the telephone and pick it up and dial 244-9455, make a pledge, and help us out here. Keep us strong because, you know, the tax-based funding has continued to go down. The costs, well, they continue to go up. And the only thing that we can do is turn to listeners and say, if you value the service, why don't you help pay for it? 244-9455. That is a number to call and make a pledge. Jack Brighton is here, sometimes host on the show, emeritus producer of the program.
That's right.
And a good friend of mine. Glad to have you here.
Thank you, David. One of the things I wanted to say is one of the things we hope is that people learn things from listening to this station. What a remarkable idea that there's still a place on the radio where people can actually get education and lifelong learning. I mean, that's the kind of role, at least one of the roles that we play on this. A lot of practical things, a lot of topics having to do with health, education, environment, science. In this case, you know, we're talking about dogs, and we do a fair number of programs dealing with animal companions. And I know that people feel strongly about that. People always have questions and want to understand how better to relate to the animals in their lives. And we hope that that's of value to you. If you listen to the show, we assume that it is. We need your support to keep this show going. That's the bottom line. 217-244-9455. Make that pledge call because we really do depend on you to keep the show going. And we also have a challenge going right now, so let's check with Maeve Riley, the editor of Patterns Magazine, our program guide, to again remind us what is the challenge.
Yeah, Jack, David had just mentioned how important new friends are to WILL, and one of our friends, Bert Gray, thinks that's true too, and he will pay half of the next 10 pledges by new friends at the basic membership level of $40. So that means you can become a friend of WILL for $20 and still be receiving patterns and know that you're supporting great programming on WILL. The number to call is 217-244-9455.
Yeah, do it for the dogs and cats in your life. Please make that pledge call. 217-244-9455. I also want to mention the website because I feel pretty strongly that it's a useful feature of what we do here at WILL. The website, will.uiuc.edu. A lot of people listen to archives of the shows. We have downloadable MP3 files of everything that we produce locally on the website. You can go there and make a pledge, and we hope you will do that. That would especially make me feel good because I justify my existence these days by the use of our website. So please go to the website. If you're listening online especially, you can make a credit card pledge right on the website or print out a form to send in a check. And again, that's will.uiuc.edu.
Well, thank you both very much. We'll talk to you again at the end of the program. For people who are listening this morning, I'd like to introduce again our guest, Stanley Coren. He is well known for having authored a number of best-selling books on dogs, including How to Speak Dog, Mastering the Art of Dog-Human Communication. That is now available in a paperback edition published by the Free Press. Also, his most recent is titled How Dogs Think, Understanding the Canine Mind, and that's also published by Free Press. Stanley Coren is a professor at the University of British Columbia and Vancouver. He's professor in the Department of Psychology. He's also director of the university's Human Neuropsychology and Perception Lab and has done a lot of research on human psychology. He's published a number of books and also many articles that have appeared in various journals, including Science, Nature, the New England Journal of Medicine, the American Journal of Public Health, and others. He is joining us this morning by telephone, and questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Well, let's get back here to the phones, and we'll talk with someone listening in Terre Haute this morning. That would be line number two. Hello.
Hello. Can you tell me, please, if a dog's intelligence is related to the size of the dog in any way? Are big dogs more intelligent than small dogs? Whenever we see these experiments, they're always done with big dogs. That's why I was wondering.
The first thing you have to understand is that there are three kinds of dog intelligence. And the first one is what we call the instinctive intelligence, and that's what the dog was bred to do. So, you know, retrievers were bred to retrieve, and herding dogs were bred to herd, and you really can't compare that. The second form is adaptive intelligence, and that's the native intelligence that any given dog has. And, you know, so, for example, we can say that, that people are smarter than cows, but, I'm sure that there's some people where you have your doubts. And so within any given breed, then, you get a lot of variety. So you get some very clever Labrador retrievers and some who are not so clever. But the third type of intelligence is what we call working and obedience intelligence. And it's the equivalent of what we would call school learning. And that we can measure. The actual intelligence of 110 breeds of dogs was obtained by contacting every dog obedience judge in North America. These are the only people in North America who have a regular job of trying to assess how well dogs have learned things. And they were really quite consistent about this. So, you know, at the very top of the list of dogs, you have the Border Collie. He's the smartest of the dogs in terms of working obedience intelligence. Number two is the Poodle. Now, some people might say the Poodle is a frou-frou dog. Well, no, the Poodle is actually a retriever, and he didn't ask for that stupid haircut. Poodle gets its name from the German Pudlin, which means a still body of water. They're not strong enough to swim against swift currents, but they're really very good as duck dogs on marshes and that sort of thing. The number three dog is the German Shepherd. The number four is the Golden Retriever. Number five is the Doberman. Number six, and now we get our first small dog, is the Little Shetland Sheepdog. It looks like a miniature collie. And number seven is the Lab. If you're starting to notice what you're getting over there, you're getting a lot of retrievers being at the top, and that's expected because retrievers really have to observe their human being and take their cues from them, and they have to be quiet when the situation requires it and that sort of thing. And you're also getting herding dogs. A lot of the herding dogs, the big and the small ones, tend to be fairly bright dogs. In fact, we have four retrievers and three herding dogs in the top 10. But also in the top 10, we've got the Little Papillon, which is a little miniature spaniel. It gets its name from the fact that its ears look like butterfly wings. And he stands 8 inches at the shoulder and maybe weighs about 10 pounds. So there's a big intelligence in that little dog's brain.
All right. Hope that gets at the question of the caller. And again, other people who are listening, if you have questions you'd like to talk with our guest, Dr. Stanley Korn, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Something else, another kind of intelligence that I would like to ask you about has to do with this. There was a book that was published a few years back. People perhaps have read it or have heard about it. This is the book Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home. It was written by a man named Rupert Sheldrake, who claimed that he had hundreds of instances where dogs would apparently, without any sort of cues that anybody could quite figure out, would go and stand at the door and wait in anticipation of the owner coming home. And it got a lot of attention. I think people have tried to look at it and ask this question, well, what's going on? Is there, in fact, something going on? And as you mentioned in the book, there are some people who have actually gone as far as to say they think that dogs, or some dogs maybe, have extrasensory perception. What's your thought about this business of dogs who know when their owners are coming home?
Well, you know, Sheldrake was trained as a physicist and chemist, wasn't trained as a behavioral researcher. He has been collecting a lot of these stories. A number of psychologists have actually started to track down these claims. Let me give you an example. One of the cases which Sheldrake talks about is a dog by the name of JT. And JT lived about a half an hour away from London by train. and his mistress would sometimes go out and go to London, and when she came back from her shopping trips or whatever, she would take different trains and that sort of thing. And the argument was that JT became restless and would immediately start to look out the door and would anticipate her coming home. Team of journalists from broadcasters from the Austrian Broadcasting Corp came down and filmed this, and they claim to have confirmed it. Now, we'll give Sheldrake credit. He invited a psychologist, a British psychologist, to come and investigate the case. And what the psychologist did was he would take the woman out on varying trips, and he had a little timer which was sort of set randomly, and he wouldn't know and she wouldn't know exactly when the timer would go off, but when it would go off, he would mark the time, and they would start to return home. Meanwhile, back at the house, they left a team of individuals to film JT. And what they basically found was that JT was a very alert little dog. He would run to the door, he would run to the window, he would run out on the porch and watch. In fact, he was at the door or at the window so often that the psychologist concluded it would have been a miracle if he hadn't been at the door when she was on her way home. So the data doesn't seem to support it. There are some things, however, which look like ESP, which dogs do seem to do. And they can anticipate, for example, the coming of an earthquake. And we think that that's due to their absolutely exquisite hearing, so that they can actually hear the grinding of the tectonic plates. Hours sometimes before the actual event occurs. And that's not within the range of what a human can see. Now, that might seem like ESP, you know, but the dogs all got upset right before the event. But as I said, we're beginning to understand that that probably has to do with the dog's hearing. And in fact, right now in mainland China, there's, as part of their national earthquake warning system, they're running several studies on dogs and other animals to see whether they can help anticipate upcoming earthquakes.
Oh, very interesting. Well, let's talk with some other people who are listening here. And we have a couple locally. First in Urbana, line number one.
Hi. I have two poodles, one that I've had for about 10 years and the other that I introduced into the household in the past year. And when people always ask me, do they get along, I'm kind of at a loss. They get along, but they don't seem to love each other, which is kind of, I mean, I'm sure, you know, not all dogs are going to like each other, but it's kind of remarkable to me when dogs seem more human-focused than other dog-focused, that we've bred them so much that they don't even like their own breed, their own kind as much as humans. And I wonder, like, how can I tell what dogs like? I mean, I know they like me, but I can't tell when they like each other. And how do I encourage them to like each other more?
Well, dogs are pack animals.
Mm-hmm.
And, you had the older dog from when it was a puppy.
Yes.
I assume. And the new dog, was he a puppy when he came in?
No, he's approximately the same age.
Oh, well, that may be the problem.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, you have two older dogs, and you bring them together, and one of the dogs has a long history with you, and the other dog has a long history in another family.
Right.
And sometimes the disruption of moving from one place to another, especially if it was a fairly stable existence, can upset a dog.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that he's not going to form affections. It's just it's going to take a little bit more time simply because of the fact that this is such a major change. And if he's been living by himself all of his life, that's not with other dogs in the house,
mm-hmm.
Then it takes sort of working out some of the rules and that sort of thing. And trying to figure out who's the boss around there. I mean, you know, which dog runs the house, you know, the new dog or the old dog. That's one of the reasons why it's a lot easier if you bring a puppy into the house.
Right.
because, in fact, the puppy will sort of learn from the older dog. Now, I have a similar situation. We just brought into the house a 9-year-old little Cavalier King Charles Spaniel. Now, those are those little Spaniel dogs with the full flowing tails that you see in all those Victorian paintings. Now, he's 9 years old, and so he's the oldest dog in my house at the moment. But both of the other two dogs are larger than he is. So he immediately knew that, you know, despite his age, size makes a difference in the dog world. And so he takes his lead from the other dogs. And because he knows exactly where he fits and that sort of thing, he feels very comfortable. And I make sure that, you know, when I pet the other dogs, I always pet him, and the other dogs get their cookies first, and he gets his cookie, and he gets fussed up, and he has settled in very quickly.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the new dog knows that he's kind of at the bottom, which I think leads to more barking. Isn't it true that the dog at the bottom is the one that guards the house, or is the gives the warning for the house?
Well, it might be simply that... So very often dogs who are feeling a wee bit insecure are going to do more of the barking.
Right.
And so if you think about it this way, you know, that dog has had everything which he owns, which is not much for dogs. I mean, they're not materialistic. But, you know, his favorite bowl, his favorite blanket, and that sort of thing, you know, are all gone.
Right.
And so, you know, what he's got left, or whatever new things, have to be guarded a little bit more jealously.
Mm-hmm. And then what about reassuring the older dog? I pet one, I have to pet the other.
That's right.
It's a good thing I don't have three dogs.
But you have to remember the order in which you do it, okay?
Okay.
The old dog, the one who has been with you for a long time, if you want him to remain to be the head of the house, then he gets petted first.
Mm-hmm.
He gets the cookie first, and that sort of thing. The other dog always gets his share, but you do it on the basis of you know, which dog you want to be number one. And generally speaking, I tend to do it on the basis of size, because that's so important for dogs. So the bigger dogs always, I assume, are going to run the place.
Even if the size is not a, like, you know, the newer dog is a few in, you know, a couple inches taller, that. In that case, does
no,
it really...
if they're close, don't worry about it.
Okay. Because I want the old dog to be the top dog. just, I don't know, psychologically.
Well, it's more of a people thing than a dog, okay? You have to understand that it is more important for a dog to know his number in the pack, that is where he fits,
mm-hmm.
rather than to be number one.
Hmm.
And in fact, there's some recent studies, these were done with wild canines, with wolves, have shown actually that the leader of the pack has more stress hormones going through his body at all times, because he's got to make all the decisions.
Huh.
And it's almost as though, well, you know, I'm just working on the assembly line over here down at the bottom, so I know where my place is. I don't have to make the decisions. I don't have to run the pack. And that makes you a little bit more comfortable. So it's a human thing. So we shouldn't try to project our own feelings out onto the dog.
Huh. Well, I'm sure that's a whole other topic. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go to another Urbana listener. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a 6-year-old miniature dachshund who is terrified of thunderstorms, and she knows when they're coming. You know, before we even hear the first clap of thunder, she starts freaking out, and she pants, and she trembles. Is there anything I can do to comfort her?
I'll tell you what you have been doing, which is probably the wrong thing.
Okay.
What you have been doing is you've been running over to comfort her the moment she gets scared.
Yes.
And what you're really doing is you're rewarding her for getting scared.
Okay.
So you have taught her that it's a good thing to be scared of thunder. And it's a very natural thing. I mean, you know, we run over to our babies and that sort of thing when they cry. But it gives the wrong message. The thing which you have to do is you have to convince the dog that there is nothing special about thunder.
Okay.
And you can do it by sort of desensitizing, and there are tapes which are available which have, you know, thunder on it, and you put them on a low level and that sort of thing. But if your dog has had any kind of obedience training, you know...
She has not.
Oh, well, then I think it's about time you did it. Okay. Because it'll give
she
you...
She has trained us.
Well, it'll give you a degree of control. I mean, you don't need much of one, okay? You would need one where you know, people stand around in a circle and you teach Lassie how to sit and lay down, okay?
Okay.
So these are usually 6 or 8 week courses, and they're not very expensive. Anyway, if you get a little bit of obedience training so that now your dog knows that they have had lessons and the words coming out of your mouth mean something, now what you do is when this thunderstorm starts to arrive and the dog starts to get panicky, what you're going to do is you're not going to comfort her, but you're going to clip her leash onto her collar, and you're going to bring her up next to you, and you're going to give her a little obedience lesson. Now, at first, the dog is going to be panicked out of its head. You know, hey, Mom, you know, you've always comforted me. Don't you hear this? But the bottom line is, if they've already been practicing in a simple obedience thing, and now you're ignoring all this noise going on and doing this fairly routine activity, then that says to the dog, well, then maybe this is not so scary. You know, leader of the pack is not responding to this as something special. You know, maybe I don't have to respond to it as something special either. And so what you end up doing is rewarding the dog for sitting when you tell him to sit during this thing and so forth. Now, depending on how long she's had the problem, you know, it could take you a few months of doing this in order to solve it, but it will solve.
One of the problems that we have, though, is so often thunderstorms happen in the middle of the night.
Well, then you put the dog in a... does the dog sleep in a kennel crate? Or
actually, she sleeps in bed with us.
Oh, she sleeps in bed with you. Well, what I would do is I'd get a little plastic kennel crate, you know, if it's a miniature doxy. Put a nice little blanket in it and that sort of thing. And on days when she is frightened, thunderstorm comes, you simply lift her up, put her in a little kennel crate, which you can keep in the bedroom with you. Just leave the door open normally. But when you put her in then, just put her in, close the door, go back to bed. Again, that's telling her, not a big problem. Here's a nice, safe place. Settle down.
But isn't that punishing her if she...
No. Out in the wild, dogs spend 14 hours a day sort of snoozing, and most of that time is spent in little places, little dens, which they scoop out for themselves, which is just large enough for them to sort of stand up and turn around. And it's comforting, it's reassuring, because nothing can get at you in that small space.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. And again, we'll go to another caller here, Munster, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I'm calling because my uncle in London passed away about a year and a half ago, and he had a little Papillon that I bought him, and I brought him back with me over here. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, how long do their memories... I've heard that they forget their masters after 2 weeks. And I don't think this can be possible because he still, if he smells, my uncle was a pipe smoker, and if he smells pipe smoke, he goes crazy. And I had that question, and also, he loves playing ball. Now, how long should I really be playing? I play about 20 minutes where I throw the ball and he runs to get it. But he would play all day long if I would do it.
Okay, well, they're two separate questions.
Mm-hmm.
So let's deal, first of all, with the dog's memory. The impression that people get that dogs don't have a long memory is because, you know, you're right that when a dog comes to a new home, the dog will seem to settle into the new home fairly quickly. But that's really being adaptive. You know, out in the wild... new members are born into the pack, older members die, so, you know, your family is changing all the time. And so that really has to be built into the dog, you know, that you do the best you can with the family or the pack that you've got. Dogs have a very long memory. That's been recognized for a long time. Part of the Odyssey tells a wonderful story that when Ulysses comes back home and he's in disguise, the only one who recognizes him after nearly 10 years is his dog Argus. And there are lots of instances in which dogs will recognize individuals for a long time. I was told a wonderful story about a guy who had a black and tan coonhound, and he named her Flannel because his ears, her ears felt just like flannel. Anyway, he had to go into the army, and he was gone for about 5 or 6 years. When he came home, his family didn't know when he was coming home. And he thought he'd surprise them. So he came home, and he had spent a long time with Flannel, and she had sort of developed a whole bunch of behaviors which were specific for him. And one of them was, you know, whenever he would come in from being away, she would do this little dance, which she would make this little woo-woo sound. Anyway, as Stephen walked into the door, you know, Flannel suddenly got up and did this little woo-woo dance. His mother, who didn't know that, you know, he had just walked in the door, said, "Flannel, what are you doing? You know, Steve's not here. You haven't made that sound since he's been gone." And she walked out, and there was Steve with Flannel. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, you know, they do remember, and their memories are quite strong, certainly for important things.
Mm-hmm.
About playing a ball, you know, that's an issue between you and the dog. Dogs will engage in play behaviors for a whole lot of reasons, sometimes for the exercise, sometimes because their genes really want them to chase things, sometimes simply because it's a good way of socializing with you. If you have a dog that really likes to retrieve, you know, they will retrieve until your arm falls off. I mean,
he does like to do.
And I had a flat-coated retriever, and I wanted to see one day just how, you know, how strong his retrieving ability was. So we were out near a waterway, and so I threw a bumper into the water, and he retrieved it. And after about 90 throws, my arm was about ready to fall off, and he was still dancing around saying, "Throw it, throw it, throw it." So, I mean, what you do is you set up the exercise periods or the play periods for a time which is comfortable for you, give the dog a little bit of exercise, and then save a little bit for the next time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much. Well, you know, I think we're about the point we're going to have to stop, and I'm sorry we have some other callers and we could keep going, but for the moment we'll have to finish. If you're interested in reading more about dogs and dog behavior, you can look at the book that we have talked about here titled How Dogs Think, Understanding the Canine Mind. It's published by Free Press. Also, perhaps an earlier book by our guest you might be interested in, a book titled How to Speak Dog, Mastering the Art of Dog-Human Communication. That's also published by the Free Press. It's out now in paper. Our guest, Stanley Coren, is professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Has written a lot about human psychology, but is maybe more widely known for his writing about dogs. And Dr. Coren, we want to say to you, thank you very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, David.
Programs here on WILL made possible by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, Gallery of Imaginative Jewelry, and Gift in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design gemstone roundtables and conflict-free diamonds from Canada. The broadcast also made possible with support from Lincoln Square Village in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including Champaign County CASA, who recruits, trains, and monitors volunteer advocates for abused and neglected children. Jack Brighton is here with the studio with me once again as we finish up here this Monday of Focus 5A.
Hello, David.
How you doing?
I'm doing fine. Good. I'd be doing much better if I saw the phones, the lights. We have this little monitor that shows the phones ringing. We want to get the phones ringing with your pledge call right now, 217-244-9455. And we have some very lonely phone volunteers who are waiting for you to make that pledge call. So we hope you will do that in this this opportunity to support the show, Focus 580, support the station, WILL, and support David Inge, the guy who does the show every day. And And let me tell you, I fill in for him, so I know what a pain it is to have to prepare for every day's show. But actually, it's a great thing to get paid to learn stuff. So I guess it's not all bad, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, that's right. It's a great thing.
But I do want people to realize how lucky they are to have David Inge as host of the show. And I hope that you will make a pledge call to support his work. 217-244-9455. And you know, we're really lucky to have David here because he's had other offers. CNN called. You know, we had calls from Fox. They wanted to have him on. Mm-hmm.
CNN said, though, that only one bearded guy, Wolf Blitzer, he's got that job. So until he leaves, I'm stuck here.
I think if you said yes, they'd can him. You know, he'd be out of there.
I don't think so.
They'd blitz him in a second.
Maybe we should talk to Maeve.
Well, why don't we do that? Let's find out how is it going on the challenge we have, Maeve.
Well, our lonely phone volunteers haven't taken any challenges, any pledges in terms of this challenge for AM. And this is something that's great for someone who has not been a friend of WILL in the past. So we're encouraging new friends to join. And Bert Gray, who is a longtime friend of WILL, will pay half of the next 10 pledges by new friends at the basic membership level of $40. So that means all you have to do is put in $20 and Bert will put in $20 and you become a friend at the $40 level. You can do that by calling 217-244-9455. You can also do it on the web, will.uiuc.edu. And Jack, I'd like to say what a great job you've been doing on the web and keeping it up to date and making all these Focus 580 programs available for folks who may not hear them all. You're in and out of the house. You may not get to hear it all at one time, but you can go to the web and listen to the archive version.
That's right. It's like TiVo for your radio.
Right.
Well, and it's something that we should mention probably more than we do, and I try to mention it occasionally, and we do on other shows, that if you have missed programs or you want to go back and hear others, Focus, AFTMEG, the market information there, Sidetrack is there, all of the local stuff is there, and any time of the day or night that you want to listen, it's there. You just have to go to the website, make a couple clicks, and you're ready to go.
Yeah, you can even download things onto your iPod or whatever MP3 player you have. You can download MP3s of all our shows, and so if you take advantage of that, hope you will help us to support it because it does cost something to do all that. 217-244-9455. And for folks who have never pledged before, I really do want to emphasize that this challenge gives you an added sort of bonus for joining. You only have to pay half the basic membership level of $40. That's what this challenge means. So hopefully that will kick you over the threshold and get you to pick up the telephone. If you've never pledged before, please give us a call right now. 217-244-9455.
That's it for us on Focus. Up next, though, is the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about diet and nutrition with registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. She joins us today following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look at what's happening now on the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. Prices are up. March wheat, 290 and three quarters, that up 3. May, 299, up 2.5. March corn, 196, up 1. May, 204, up 1. July corn, 211, up 3 quarters. December, 228 and a quarter, up 3 quarters. March beans, 501 and a half, up 2. May, 504 and a quarter, up 2. November, 522 and a half, that up 1 and 3 quarters.